The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And, of course, we'll be reading from the edition dated April 15th, 2001. Our first article from today is from the Week magazine Internet service. Would Republicans really vote against raising the debt ceiling? With so much at stake, some wonder if the GOP would really risk letting the government default on its debts. Will the Democrats call their bluff? The U.S. government narrowly avoided being shut down by recalcitrant lawmakers last week, but the real fight is yet to come. Congress must approve a $1 trillion increase in the federal debt ceiling within the next 5 weeks, or face the prospect of a U.S. government default. House Republicans, led by Speaker John Boehner, are demanding deep spending cuts in exchange for their support, but some doubt whether the GOP will follow through, given the extraordinarily high stakes. Would the GOP really vote against raising the federal debt limit? Yes, the Republicans are capable of anything. Another weak, another hostage strategy, says Stephen Bannon at Washington Monthly. And yes, the stakes are significantly higher in this fight. But that doesn't mean the GOP won't be willing to use their vote as a bargaining chip. Indeed, they've been rather shameless about it. Economists, business leaders, and government officials have all told the GOP to reject the political games and do what's right. So far, they've said no. What makes you think they'll comply now? On debt ceiling, a simple request, a clean bill. No, the GOP is in a losing position. The Republicans know deep down they can't win this one, says Nate Silver at the New York Times, which is why Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, is privately discouraging his colleagues from filibustering a vote. And Boehner himself has warned of a financial disaster if the debt limit hike doesn't pass. That doesn't sound like much of a negotiating position to me. A White House willing to play hardball could get whatever it wants on this one. Risks to Boehner and debt ceiling brinkmanship. If only Obama had the guts to call the GOP's bluff. This White House has shown it isn't willing to play hardball, says Jonathan Chait at the New Republic. In fact, in every budget fight so far, it has willingly handed the GOP concession after concession. But Obama has the upper hand here. He can expose and force Republicans to defend their position. If the GOP wants to take hostages, Obama should announce that he is finished paying ransom. And yet the battle will be waged on the GOP's terms. Boehner will rely on the same playbook as he did on the budget fight, says Alex Altman at Time. That is, refusing any reasonable deal on the basis that he'll be unable to sell it to congressional hardliners like Ron Paul and Michelle Bachmann. Face it, Democrats are fighting the debt limit brawl on Republican terms. By the time the votes come, the GOP will already have won. Now the first item from the main stories of the printed edition of the Week magazine, Gaddafi looks for a way out. What happened? With a rebel uprising still raging in the east and NATO planes continuing to patrol the skies, Libyan dictator Muammar al-Gaddafi this week appeared to be looking for an exit. Two of his sons, Saif and Sadi, sent representatives to meet with Western diplomats and reportedly said they could persuade their father to step aside and make way for a constitutional democracy. The catch? Saif would head the transitional government? Rebel leaders dismissed the proposal as unacceptable. These guys have so much blood on their hands, said opposition spokesman Mustafa Gariani. There's no way to replace Gaddafi with a small Gaddafi. It's also not clear that Gaddafi approved that offer, but after the defection of his foreign minister and right-hand man Moussa Koussa to Britain last week, the despot is increasingly isolated and increasingly reliant on his son's advice. The two-month-old civil war, meanwhile, appears to be headed for a stalemate. Opposition leaders complain that their poorly armed fighters lacked air cover against Gaddafi's artillery. NATO, which has taken control of the Libya operation as the U.S. stepped back, said it had to stage fewer bombing raids because pilots were struggling to distinguish regime loyalists from rebels. Gaddafi's forces, NATO said, had learned to place their armored vehicles and big guns in densely populated areas, knowing that the West would hold its fire out of fear it might kill civilians. Now here's what the editorial said. The military deadlock is partly the result of Obama's insistence on limiting U.S. involvement, said the Washington Post. To lower America's profile in the Middle East, Obama this week grounded the AC-130 and the A-10 Warthog planes that have been eviscerating Gaddafi's tanks and other vehicles. No other NATO member can deploy such effective air-to-ground attack planes. This withholding of U.S. resources will only lead to the unnecessary extension of a bloody conflict. Everyone wants this civil war to end, sooner than later, said the Tulsa World. But we won't stop the bloodshed by installing another Gaddafi as Libya's ruler. Saif and younger brother Mutasim are fierce rivals, and their supporters will go to war if one of the sons is allowed to replace the father. If we really want to get rid of this fractious family, we'll have to forget about prosecuting them at the International Criminal Court, said the Boston Globe, indeed leaving the door open for them to seek sanctuary in some other country may speed their departure. What the columnists had to say. Unless Gaddafi is offered immunity from prosecution, it's likely he'll stay in Libya and fight on until the bitter end, said Dwayne Wickham in USA Today. The dictator doesn't want to end up like former Liberian President Charles Taylor, who went into exile in 2003 as part of a deal to end the country's civil war, and 3 years later was handed over to the War Crimes Tribunal. As hard as it is for many to swallow, offering Gaddafi a get-out-of-jail-free card is the only thing that will quickly put an end to the carnage. Gaddafi won't be bombed into submission, said former Republican Representative Kurt Weldon in the New York Times. But for the right deal, he might step down. I first met Gaddafi when I visited Libya as a congressman in 2004, and I'm now back in the country with a private delegation at the request of Gaddafi's chief of staff to help negotiate the handover of power. That handover will only happen if we include Saif, a powerful businessman and politician who has been a moderating influence on his father's regime. Until Gaddafi's departure is guaranteed, the West should continue to ratchet up the pressure, said David Brooks, also in the New York Times. The regime is continually being weakened by airstrikes and psychological warfare. The squeeze is working, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. An intelligence source says that the regime only has enough cash to last 2 to 3 months. From this financial perspective, Gaddafi could be described as a dictator in liquidation. Meanwhile, the next item is Ivory Coast's turmoil. His forces battered by French airstrikes, Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo finally gave up a 5-month battle to retain power and began negotiating his departure from the country this week. Gbagbo lost his re-election bid last November to his longtime political enemy Alassane Ouattara, but refused to recognize the results of the vote, and forces loyal to the two men clashed sporadically for months. Last week, those skirmishes turned into a war as Ouattara's troops surrounded the capital and tens of thousands of people fled. After France, Ivory Coast's former colonizer, which still has troops stationed there, destroyed Gbagbo's heavy weaponry, the army deserted en masse. Hunkered down in the presidential palace, Gbagbo said he would step down, but negotiations were stalled over his unwillingness to allow Ouattara to succeed him. The two men have been enemies for years, said Roger Kaplan in the American Spectator. Gbagbo, a Christian, is supported by the largely Christian South, while Ouattara, a Muslim, has his base in the mostly Muslim North and among the descendants of immigrants from Burkina Faso. Those two sides fought a vicious civil war a decade ago, and the underlying issues, particularly surrounding whether ethnic Burkinabes can claim citizenship, were never resolved. At this point, even if Gbagbo steps down, there is still a danger of an all-out tribal war that could draw in all kinds of scavengers and bandits from across the region and spread across all of West Africa. The human toll has already been devastating, said Evelyn Leopold in HuffingtonPost.com. More than 1 million people have fled their homes, many of them crossing the border to Liberia. Gbagbo's forces and supporters have committed untold numbers of rapes, killings, torture, looting, including burning people alive in Abidjan, while a massacre of 800 civilians in the western town of Dikoy is blamed on Ouattara forces. This horror is a visceral example of how one very stubborn man can ruin a nation, said Elizabeth Dickinson in foreignpolicy.com. Gbagbo's refusal to give in despite sanctions caused the economy to shut down and the country to default on its debt. If and when this political standoff ends, the Ivory Coast is going to be broken. The next item is Obama's tribunal reversal. The Obama administration reversed itself this week and said it would try confessed 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed before a military commission in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The move, forced by bipartisan congressional opposition to holding terrorist trials in the U.S., marks an abandonment of President Obama's campaign pledge to close Guantanamo and conduct civilian trials for the suspected terrorists held there, including Mohammed. Attorney General Eric Holder first announced plans to try Mohammed in New York City in 2009, provoking heated protests by congressional Republicans, New York Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer, and New York City political leaders. Congress last year withheld funds to close Guantanamo and transfer the detainees to the U.S. Republicans are gleefully claiming victory, said Paul Campos in the DailyBeast.com, but KSM and Al-Qaeda are the real winners. Too weak to genuinely threaten the U.S., they nevertheless understood that they could win a great victory by creating a climate of irrational fear and rampant hysteria. A small terrorist organization has now forced America to betray one of its most basic values, the right to a fair trial, in the illusory pursuit of a world in which we are safe from the terrorists. What a sellout by the administration, said Dahlia Lithwick in Slate.com. The U.S. has successfully tried dozens of terrorists in civilian courts and jailed them here in the U.S. Despite its professed commitment to constitutional principles, the Obama administration crumbled under the bullying, fear-mongering, and demagoguery of those seeking to create two separate kinds of American law. Our justice system was never designed for trials of foreigners accused of acts of terrorism, said the New York Post in an editorial. Civilian trials could have been a disaster given their strict rules of evidence. KSM and his bloodthirsty buddies are war criminals, and they don't deserve the rights and privileges of American citizens, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Perhaps Obama is beginning to appreciate the hellish dilemmas faced by his predecessor, George W. Bush, and why he created Guantanamo in the first place. It's called Growing Up the Hard Way. And now, back to the controversy of the week, Ryan's blueprint, how to cut $4 trillion by really trying. Forget the battle over billions, said Mark McKinnon in the DailyBeast.com. While Congress and the White House continue to battle over symbolic cuts to the 2011 budget, GOP Representative Paul Ryan this week released a bold, long-term plan to cut trillions from the deficit and save the country from its spiraling fiscal crisis. Ryan's proposed spending plan for 2012 and beyond is the most comprehensive and most courageous budget reform proposal any of us have seen in our lifetime, said David Brooks in the New York Times. The plan cuts federal spending by an impressive $4 trillion over the next decade. But the most important thing is how it reforms Medicaid and Medicare, our most costly entitlement programs. Medicare would become a federally subsidized private insurance program, in which tomorrow's seniors would get a fixed amount of money with which to buy coverage. Medicaid would be provided in the form of block grants to the states, giving them control over how best to spend the money. Ryan's budget plan is just the start of a prolonged debate, but someone in Washington has finally grasped reality with both hands. Give Paul Ryan credit, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com. He's managed to use reform to pretty up the Republicans' dream of spending much, much less on health care for the poor and the elderly. Distributing Medicaid in the form of block grants to the state simply means that if costs rise or more people fall into poverty, the answer will be too bad. To take a meat cleaver to Medicare, Ryan would replace fee-for-service coverage with a defined federal subsidy to seniors. As medical costs rise and as seniors face deductibles and coverage limits, they'd have to shoulder more and more of the cost of health care, or do without it. This is nothing more than a heartless plan to cut spending, whatever the consequences. It's even worse than that, said Harold Meyerson in the Washington Post. At the same time Ryan pushes more health care costs onto the poor and the elderly, he provides a huge reduction in the top income tax rate, from 35% to 25%. All told, Ryan would reduce federal tax revenues by $4 trillion over 10 years. If he were honestly just trying to pay off the deficit rather than dismantle the welfare state and repeal the 20th century, wouldn't a tax hike on the wealthiest Americans make more sense? Ryan's plan does eliminate most tax deductions, said Jonathan Chait in the Republic, New Republic Online, but that massive regressive income tax cut for the wealthy is the plan's Achilles heel. Once the public realizes the GOP wants to end Medicare in order to finance a huge tax cut for people who don't really need it, Ryan's plan will be dead in the water. Ryan's tax cut proposal may need some tweaking, said Jacob Weisberg in Slate.com, but the Medicare portion of his plan is brave, radical, and smart. The $15,000 a year he'd provide seniors should buy excellent coverage. Medicare now consumes more than $500 billion a year and is rising fast. Its cost is crowding out everything else that Washington does or might do. Ryan is simply asking that the elderly enter the health care world the rest of us live in, with co-payments, deductibles, and managed care. If that's too radical and heartless for Democrats, then they're free to propose a better solution to our fiscal crisis. Thanks to Paul Ryan, the ball is now in their court. And now let's turn to the very popular feature in the Week magazine called Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for Mount Everest after a team of mountaineers and a Sherpa guide began removing 11,000 pounds of garbage, empty bottles, oxygen canisters, and abandoned tents and ropes from the slopes of the world's largest mountain. Lost Springs, Wyoming. It was a good week for Lost Springs, which is undergoing a population boom, according to the 2010 census. The town now has four people living in it, up from the one who was counted in the year 2000. It was a good week for dumb luck after Richard Paler, a 55-year-old truck driver, accidentally saved his own life in Pennsylvania as he was choking on an apple. He lost control of his truck, which hit a median. The jarring impact dislodged the apple from his throat. I guess I have to thank the wall, Paler said. It was a bad week for forgetting the date after Evanston, Illinois residents call City Hall in outrage over a local newspaper's report that only those who bought a snow removal sticker from the city would have their streets cleared. City officials pointed out that the paper was printed on April 1st and said there would be no fee. It was a bad week for transparency after President Obama accepted an award for supporting government transparency at a private ceremony from which the media and the public were excluded. And it was a bad week for learning from your mistakes after Michelle Elaine Ostomian of San Luis Obispo, California, convicted of forging drug prescriptions, showed up in court with a doctor's note asking the judge to delay her sentencing. Well, the doctor's note itself had been forged. And that was Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4 on The Week magazine for April 15th, 2011. Now let's turn to the People's section of the week. The first item, Hitchens' stalwart atheism. Christopher Hitchens' battle with cancer has not shaken his atheism, said Mick Brown in the London Telegraph. The contrarian writer, 62, is now dealing with stage 4 esophageal cancer. Esophageal cancer. And the thing to note about stage 4, he says, is that there's no stage 5. Hitchens does not believe in an afterlife, and that, he concedes, makes the thought of death even more difficult to accept. It's more that you're at the party and you're tapped on the shoulder and told you have to leave, says Hitchens. The party is still going on, but it's going on without you, and even people who swear to remember you are really not going to do so. On the other hand, he says, heaven sounds like an even worse prospect. You get tapped on the shoulder, but guess what? The party's going on forever. You have to stay. And not only that, but you have to have a good time. The boss says so. He shudders at the thought. Anything eternal is probably intolerable. And although the atheist position may be bleak, at least, says Hitchens, it's courageous. We don't want to be annihilated. We just think that the overall likelihood is that we rejoin the molecular cycle when we die. We don't wish it to be true, but we face it. The next item, the Bush's life after the White House. Laura Bush is still adjusting to life at a slower pace, said Edward Lewine in the New York Times magazine. The former First Lady and her husband, former President George W. Bush, say life on their ranch in Crawford, Texas, couldn't be more different from their days in the White House. I didn't really know how stressed I was until I moved home and wasn't, she says. Having private chefs in both Washington and the Texas governor's mansion has left her incompetent in everyday matters such as cooking. For 14 years, I never cooked, she says. This last Christmas, I cooked lunch for my mother and my daughter. I just roasted the turkey breast. The whole turkey seemed too difficult. She's also had to adjust to the amount of time she spends with her husband. George and I do everything together. Really, she says. We read at the same time. We go to bed early every single night. We had all of our breakfasts and dinners together. This arrangement generally suits her, if not for one annoying trait of his, smacking on chewing gum. For his part, the former president seems perfectly content with their new life. He's always worried about our small lake that is stocked with bass because he loves to fish. There's always some concern. It's too hot. It's too cold. Are the fish not getting enough feed? That's what he worries about these days. Lowe's Wild Youth. Rob Lowe was once an uber nerd, said Vanessa Gregorius in Vanity Fair. I apologize for that name, but I really can't figure it out. Anyway, the actor, 47, has been a heartthrob since he stopped onto a movie set in the 1980s, but he swears that wasn't always the case. He grew up in Dayton, Ohio, and after his parents divorced in his early teens, Rob Lowe's mother moved the family to swanky Malibu, California. The cool girls in Malibu had no time for me, he says. I wasn't a beach volleyball player, a surfer, or a quasi-burnout. After scoring a role in Francis Ford Coppola's The Outsiders, he became a member of Hollywood's Brat Pack. Suddenly, he was dating beauties like Demi Moore and Natasha Kinski. When he went out with Princess Stephanie of Monaco, he discovered that she had a poster of him on her wall, where I'm oiled like a rent boy with my shirt off and sweatpants rolled down to my pubic hair. For a decade, he competed with Charlie Sheen to see who could play harder, then show up for work, and still kick ass. The winner? Charlie by a nose, Lowe says. He has no regrets. The Brat Pack is timeless. We should all be so lucky to create things that we're still talking about 25 years later. Always interesting items there in the People's section of the Week magazine. Now we're going to turn to the briefing. This week, the briefing item is radioactive fuel rods, the silent threat. Japan's nuclear crisis has highlighted the danger of the spent fuel rods piling up outside America's nuclear plants. Well, first of all, what are fuel rods? They are the source of the fission reaction that makes nuclear plants work. Fuel rods are long metal tubes filled with uranium that's been formed into pellets. When these rods are placed inside the reactor, nuclear fission occurs, generating heat. That, in turn, boils water and creates steam, which powers turbines and produces electricity. When the uranium fuel is used up, usually after about 18 months, the spent rods are generally moved to deep pools of circulating water to cool down for about 10 years, though they remain dangerously radioactive for about 10,000 years. How do the Japanese store their spent fuel rods? The same way we do in the U.S. When the earthquake and tsunami knocked out the cooling systems at the multiple nuclear reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi plant, it wasn't just the reactors that were affected. Several spent fuel rod pools also lost electric power, shutting down pumps. Water in the cooling pool stopped circulating and began to boil off or leak out. As the water level fell, the spent fuel rods were exposed and their temperatures soared. Several began to melt down, releasing extremely high levels of radiation into the air. Could that happen in the U.S.? It's within the realm of possibility. The U.S. has 104 operating nuclear plants, and most store all the spent fuel rods they've ever used right on site. All told, there are 71,900 tons of spent fuel rods at the U.S. nuke plants, the vast majority of them sitting in pools that today are mostly full, according to a recent state-by-state tally by the Associated Press. The spent fuel pools are currently holding, on the average, four times more than their designs intended, said Robert Alvarez of the Institute for Policy Studies. U.S. officials insist they have stricter safety standards for the pools than Japan does. But former Nuclear Regulatory Commission member Peter Bradford said, "The phrase, 'it can't happen here,' is an invitation to disaster." Is there a threat of terrorism? There's little doubt of that. The National Academy of Sciences warned Congress in 2006 that if terrorists flew a plane into the pools or bombed the pools after crashing through a plant's security perimeter, they could expose the fuel rods, causing the release of large quantities of radioactive materials to the environment. David Lochbaum, head of the Nuclear Safety Program for the Union of Concerned Scientists, told a congressional hearing last week that while nuclear fuel inside reactors is protected by multiple thick layers of metal and concrete shielding, spent fuel pools are typically covered with sheet metal roofs like that in a Sears storage shed. Pete Stockton, a former security expert with the Department of Energy, warns that if fuel rods were exposed and melted down near a populated area, the resulting radiation would force a massive evacuation. The Indian Point plant, 35 miles north of Manhattan, for example, could take out New York City, Stockton said. Is there a better way of storing rods? One possibility is to seal them in an above-ground dry cask made of concrete and steel, as Germany does. Casks are already in use across the U.S. on a limited basis due to the cost and the absence of regulations compelling utilities to use them. Enclosing all spent fuel rods in casks would cost about or between $5 billion and $10 billion, experts estimate. The nuclear industry has strongly resisted taking on that cost. Why not bury the rods under a remote mountain? Well, that was actually the plan until 2 years ago. In the 1980s, the federal government launched a plan to bury spent fuel in nickel alloy chambers 1,000 feet below the surface of Nevada's Yucca Mountain. George W. Bush greenlighted the Yucca Mountain repository in 2002, and nuclear utilities have levied more than $20 billion in charges to pay for its construction. But opponents led by now Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada argued that waste could eventually leak into the water table 1,000 feet below the repository and worried Yucca Mountain would become a terrorist target. Leave it on site where it is, Reid argued in 2009, saves the country billions and billions of dollars. Last year, President Barack Obama, delivering on a campaign promise that helped him win Nevada in 2008, called off the stalled project and named a Blue Ribbon Commission to come up with something else. How urgent is the situation? Fairly urgent. The NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, predicts that at the rate we're discarding rods, about 2,000 tons a year, we'll run out of existing storage space by 2015. The Japanese crisis has sparked a new debate about fuel rod storage in Congress, with some congressmen pushing for reconsideration of Yucca Mountain. During hearings last week, William Lewis, chief operating officer of a New Jersey-based nuclear plant, said the industry keeps storing fuel rods in pools next to nuke plants because the government has provided no better alternative. It's really our lack of national strategy of what we're going to do with it, he said. And a footnote to this briefing about radioactive fuel rods, that's entitled The Scandinavian Solution. Sweden and Finland are no longer merely talking about the possibility of storing spent fuel rods underground, an approach known as deep storage. They've approved and begun work on their own Yucca Mountains. Sweden has chosen a site at Forsmark, and work on an underground nuclear storage facility is expected to be completed in about a decade. Finland has already begun blasting a network of tunnels for a deep storage cavern called Onkalo, which it hopes to have up and running in 2020. Among other cutting-edge innovations, these sites will line the storage shafts with bentonite, which, when exposed to water, swells, sealing off the spent fuel rods and protecting them from the earthquakes and underground water flows. The group spearheading the construction says that sealing fuel rods inside corrosion-resistant copper canisters, bedrock, and bentonite guarantees safe burial for 100,000 years. We're going to be the ones to set the standard for final disposal, a spokesman said. And now it's time to turn to the best columns in the United States, according to The Week magazine. Our first one is entitled, Writing Off the Women of Afghanistan, written by Kathleen Parker of The Washington Post. What about the women? That said, Kathleen Parker, should be a pivotal question as the U.S. negotiates a possible reconciliation with the Taliban in Afghanistan and figures out how to deal with the emerging nations of a post-revolutionary Islamic world. Yet whenever women ask that question, we're told, too bad about the women. They'll suffer. Indeed, a senior Obama administration official recently said that peace could only be secured in Afghanistan if gender issues and other pet rocks were put aside. Gender issues? We're not talking about subsidized daycare here. We're talking about the rights of girls to attend school without having acid thrown in their faces. We're talking about the freedom to work, to make decisions about one's own life, to seek an education and to be safe to walk on the streets without a male escort, to be fully human, in other words. That should not be negotiable. It's no accident that the nations that stone women to death for breaking primitive norms are the same ones that dispatch jihadists to the West to slaughter civilians. There can be no security or progress in Afghanistan, Egypt, or elsewhere as long as those in power treat half the population like chattel. The next column is entitled, Democrats Should Love the Birthers, and it's written by Clarence Page in the Chicago Tribune. Is Donald Trump a secret agent for the Democrats? Asked Clarence Page. It's a reasonable question now that the celebrity billionaire is gaining attention for his publicity-seeking lark of a presidential run by becoming a birther. The birthers, of course, are the conspiracy theorists who insist that President Obama was born in a foreign nation, despite documents showing he was born in the state of Hawaii, as well as birth announcements in two Hawaiian newspapers at that time. By pandering to the birther movement, Trump only makes Republicans look like the crazy party, hurting his chances with the sensible independent swing voters it needs to win general elections. Unfortunately, polls now find that 51% of likely Republican primary voters don't believe that Obama is a U.S. citizen. As a result, even mainstream Republicans give evasive responses to the birther question, which has become shorthand for whether you're part of Obama's America or not. For Obama and the Democrats, the best response is to say nothing at all. Why get in the way of the opposition party when they're coddling their own kooks? And the next column from the Week magazine, Why Bonds is Baseball's Scapegoat, by Buzz Bissinger in the DailyBeast.com. Free Barry Bonds, said Buzz Bissinger. The former home run record setter is now on trial in a federal court in California after a prolonged witch hunt by prosecutors that has cost taxpayers more than $50 million. Why is Bonds facing criminal charges for lying about his use of steroids when most baseball players during his era used performance-enhancing substances? For one reason, he was considered surly and arrogant and unlikable. Contrast Bonds' treatment with that of the disgraced former All-American hero Mark McGwire, who looked like a supersized Shrek when he hit a record-breaking 70 homers in 1998. But McGwire was white and beloved. After dodging the question for years, he finally admitted, amid tears, that he had used steroids. He's back in baseball's good graces as a St. Louis Cardinals coach. Because Bonds refused to beg for forgiveness, he now faces jail time, and prosecutors are publicly humiliating him, with an ex-girlfriend testifying about his shrunken testicles. Enough! If federal prosecutors need scapegoats, how about going after the Wall Street financiers whose funny money thievery nearly destroyed the country? And now let's turn to the last word, a very popular feature in the Week magazine. This week, the last word is entitled Blind Like a Bat. Daniel Kish can't see, says Michael Finkel, but he's learned how to navigate the world with echolocation. The first thing Daniel Kish does when I pull up to his tidy gray bungalow in Long Beach, California, is make fun of my driving. You're going to leave it that far from the curb? He asks. He's standing on his stoop, a good 10 paces from my car. I am indeed parked about a foot and a half from the curb. The second thing Kish does in his living room a few minutes later is remove his prosthetic eyeballs. A couple of times a day they need to be cleaned. They get gummy, he explains. He wipes them gently with a white cloth and places them back in. Kish was born with an aggressive form of cancer called retinoblastoma, which attacks the retinas. To save his life, both of his eyes were removed by the time he was 13 months old. Since his infancy, Kish is now 44 years old. He has been adapting to his blindness in such remarkable ways that some people have wondered if he's playing a grand practical joke. He knew my car was poorly parked because he produced a brief, sharp click with his tongue. The sound waves he created traveled at a speed of more than 1,000 feet per second, bounced off every object around him, and returned to his ears at the same rate. Kish has trained himself to hear these slight echoes and to interpret their meaning. Standing on his front stoop, he could visualize with an extraordinary degree of precision the two pine trees on his front lawn, the curb at the edge of his street, and finally, a bit too far from that curb, my rental car. Kish has given a name to what he does. He calls it flash sonar, but it's more commonly known by its scientific term, echolocation. Bats, of course, use echolocation, beluga whales too, dolphins, and Daniel Kish. He is so accomplished at echolocation that he's able to pedal his mountain bike through streets heavy with traffic and on precipitous dirt trails. He climbs trees. He camps out by himself deep in the wilderness. He's lived for weeks at a time in a tiny cabin, a 2-mile hike from the nearest road. He travels around the globe, essentially, though, in a way that is unfamiliar to nearly any other human being. Kish can see. This is not enough for him. Kish is seeking, despite a lack of support from every mainstream blind organization in America, nothing less than a profound reordering of the way the world views blind people and the way blind people view the world. He's tired of being told that the blind are best served by staying close to home, sticking only to memorized routes, and depending on the unreliable benevolence of the sighted. Kish preaches complete and unfettered independence, even if the result produces the occasional bloody gash or broken bone. Kish and a handful of co-workers run a nonprofit organization called World Access for the Blind, headquartered in Kish's home. World Access offers training on how to gracefully interact with one's environment, using echolocation as a primary tool. So far in the decade it has existed, the organization has introduced more than 500 students to echolocation. Kish is not the first blind person to use echolocation, but he's the only one to meticulously document it, to break it down into its component parts, and to figure out how to teach it. His dream is to help all sight-impaired people see the world as clearly as he does. Kish's click is a thing of beauty. He snaps the tip of his tongue briefly and firmly against the roof of his mouth, creating a momentary vacuum that pops upon release, a sound very much like pushing the igniter on a gas stove. A team of Spanish scientists recently studied Kish's click and deemed it acoustically ideal for capturing echoes. A machine, they wrote, could do no better. Echolocation works because our ears, conveniently, are located on both sides of our head. When there's a noise off to one side, the sound reaches the closer ear about a millisecond, a thousandth of a second, before it reaches the farther ear. That's enough of a gap for the auditory cortex of our brains to process the information. It's rare that we turn the wrong way when someone calls our name. In fact, we're able to process with phenomenal accuracy sounds just a few degrees off center. Having two ears, like having two eyes, also gives us the auditory equivalent of depth perception. We hear in stereo 3D. Kish does not go around clicking like a madman. He uses his click sparingly, and depending on his situation, varies the volume. When he's outside, he'll throw a loud click. In good conditions, he can hear a building 1,000 feet away, a tree from 30 feet, a person from 6 feet. Up close, he can echolocate a 1-inch diameter pole. He can tell the difference between a pickup truck, a passenger car, and an SUV. I accompanied Kish on several occasions as he cruised the busy streets of Long Beach. The outside world is an absolute cacophony. Every car, person, dog, stroller, and bicycle makes a sound. Then there are the silent obstacles, what Kish calls urban furniture. Benches, traffic signs, telephone poles, postal boxes, fire hydrants, light posts, parked vehicles. Kish hears the sonic reflections from his click, even in a place teeming with ambient noise. It's like recognizing a familiar voice in a crowd, he says. The load upon his mind is undoubtedly immense, yet he casually processes everything, constructing and memorizing a mental map of his route, all while maintaining an intricate conversation with me. It's so extraordinary that it seems to border on the magical. When it's all put together, says Kish, he has very rich, very detailed pictures in his head. In color, I ask? No, he says, I've never seen color, so there's no color. It's more like a sonar, like on the Titanic. Kish can hardly remember a time when he didn't click. He came to it on his own, intuitively, at age 2, about a year after his second eye was removed. Kish was fortunate that his mother never tried to dissuade him from clicking. "That tongue click was everything to me," he says. He has a vivid recollection of sneaking out his bedroom window in the middle of the night at age 2 1/2 and climbing over a fence into his neighbor's yard. "I was in the habit of exploring whatever I sensed around me," he wrote in his journal. He soon wondered what was in the yard of the next house and the one after that. "I was on the other side of the block before someone discovered me prowling around their backyard and had the police return me home to completely flummoxed parents." He went to mainstream schools and relied almost exclusively on echolocation to orient himself, though at the time neither he nor his mom had any concept of what he was doing. There was no one to explain it. There was no one to help me enhance it. And we all just kind of took it for granted, he says. My family and friends were like, "Yeah, he does this funny click thing and he gets around." He rode his bike with wild abandon. "I used to go to the top of a hill and scream, 'Dive bomb!' and ride down as fast as I could," he says. This is when he was 8 years old. "The neighborhood kids would scatter. One day I lost control of the bicycle, crashed through these trash cans, and smashed into a metal light pole. It was a violent collision. I had blood all over my face. I picked myself up and went home." It was never Kish's goal to run a foundation dedicated to the blind. He planned to be a psychologist, but he could not ignore the fact that few blind people enjoyed anything close to his freedom of movement. And he had grown weary of society's attitude toward the blind. "I am belittled, patronized, disrespected, invaded, restricted, and presumed weak, vulnerable, or otherwise incapacitated," he wrote in his journal. So in 2001, he started World Access for the Blind. Blindness, Kish says, should be understood by both the blind and the sighted as nothing more than an inconvenience. "Most of my life," he writes, "I never even thought of myself as blind. In fact, I saw myself as smarter, more agile, stronger, and generally more capable than most other boys my age." There are a couple of reasons why the organization hasn't trained more students. The first is Kish's general ethos about how blind children should be raised. "Running into a pole is a drag, but never being allowed to run into a pole is a disaster," he writes. "Pain is part of the price of freedom." This attitude is not wildly popular, especially in a safety-first nation like the United States. Also, echolocation is not easy to master. Kish compares it to piano lessons. "Anyone can learn basics. Very few will make it to Carnegie Hall. Only about 10% of the people who learn echolocation," he admits, "find their abilities immediately enriched." And then there is resistance from mainstream organizations. The National Federation of the Blind, the largest blind organization in America, does not endorse Kish's work. "Let's just say he's unique," says John Paré, the Federation's executive director for strategic initiatives, clearly straining to be polite. Paré believes that for most people, echolocation is not worth the tremendous effort required to grasp it. "We urge people to learn how to use a long white cane," he says. Kish has an idea, something he's been quietly working on for more than a decade. What Kish envisions is the next leap in human echolocation. His idea is to become more like a bat. Bats are the best. Some can fly in complete darkness, navigating around thousands of other bats while nabbing insects 1 millimeter wide. They can perceive high-frequency sound waves beyond the range of human hearing, waves that are densely packed together, whose echoes give precise detail. There is evidence that humans could be that good. Bats have tiny brains. Just the auditory cortex of a human brain is many times larger than the entire brain of a bat. To echolocate like bats, humans need a way to create bat-like sound waves, and we need to be able to hear those waves. In pursuit of these goals, Kish has spent time in New Zealand with Leslie Kay, who worked on underwater sonar for the British Navy during the Cold War. For nearly 50 years, Kay tinkered with ideas for helping the blind to see with sound. He eventually introduced, after many weeks of consultation with Kish, a product called the K-Sonar, a flashlight-sized machine that attaches to a blind person's cane and emits ultrasonic pulses. The pulses are then digitally translated into tones humans can hear through earphones. Flowers actually sound soft, says Kish. Stones sound hard and crisp. It pretty much represents the physical environment as music. If money were no object, Kish believes that blind people could essentially mimic bats within 5 years. Our hearing, Kish says, can be increased tenfold through surgical augmentation, basically inner ear microphone implants. Combine the two, and it's possible that the blind will be able to take up tennis. Kish figures that it would require $15 million to prove whether or not his idea is feasible. He fears he'll never get the opportunity. It's virtually impossible to gather funding for experimental devices for the blind, he says. The blind population is seen as a lost cause. Kish's patience is running thin. He is still reaching out to scientists and studying scholarly journals and pondering ways to conjure the money. But more and more these days, he finds himself daydreaming about moving to a cabin in the woods and devoting himself to playing music, to writing. Let the new crop of echolocators take over the research and the networking and the panhandling. So for the foreseeable future, at least, Kish will continue to click in his usual way, and the sighted world will continue to not notice. That article was by Michael Finkel from a longer article that originally appeared in Men's Journal, used with permission, of course. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine. As we get near the end of the program for this week, let's take a look at the health and science section and an item entitled, How Humans Came to the Americas. The first Americans, many anthropologists have believed, were Asians who crossed a land bridge at what is now the Bering Strait about 14,000 years ago. But the discovery of a huge cache of stone tools outside Austin undermines that theory and suggests the Americas were settled earlier than previously believed. A team from Texas A&M University has excavated 15,528 objects at the site, including blades and chisels thought to be nearly 15,500 years old. Those finds significantly predate what was long considered the oldest American settlement in Clovis, New Mexico, where 13,000-year-old spear tips were unearthed in 1929. Pre-Clovis finds in North and South America in recent decades have poked holes in the theory that the Clovis people were the first Americans. But the Texas site, A&M anthropologist Michael Waters tells BBC.com, is almost like a baseball bat to the side of the head of the archaeological community to wake up. The Austin site not only proves that people lived in America pre-Clovis, but suggests that they came over and spread south in boats, since glaciers were likely still blocking overland paths from Alaska to Texas 15,000 years ago. Now, says Waters, we need to develop a new model for the peopling of the Americas. Now from Talking Points, testing scandal, when school reform is a fraud. It's the biggest fad in public education, judging schools and teachers based on their students' performance on standardized tests. But now the folly of that free market approach to public education has been exposed, said Diane Ravitch in thedailybeast.com. An investigation by USA Today found evidence of widespread test fraud in Washington, D.C. schools during the tenure of controversial Chancellor Michelle Rhee. In Rhee's most successful school, the newspaper found the average student's tests had 12.7 erasures in which wrong answers were changed to correct ones. Usually, there is less than one such wrong-to-right erasure per test. The pattern of erasures throughout the district strongly points to cheating, desperate behavior by principals and teachers trying to save their jobs and meet their targets. Rhee's hard-edge methods have been immensely popular in Congress, the states, and think tanks on the left and the right, but they may be based on an illusion. The evidence of official cheating is clearly disturbing, said Jay Matthews in the Washington Post, but let's not forget that Reed did much good for D.C. children. Testing is still the best tool we have to assess student achievement relatively quickly and focus efforts where they're most needed. Clearly, though, we have to guard against relying too much on test results that can be distorted. That should have been obvious even before this scandal, said James Linfesty in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. George W. Bush's first Secretary of Education, Rod Page, oversaw the Houston miracle, in which teacher incentives seemed to vastly improve test scores. Page had to resign when it was discovered that those results were phony. The problem appears to be rampant. In recent years, suspicious erasure rates have been found in Atlanta, Detroit, Baltimore, and at least 6 other states. And now a few final notes from Talking Points as we get near the end of our program today. The Nixon Library and Museum in Yorba Linda, California, will no longer refer to Watergate as a coup. The National Archives has taken over operation of the museum from a group of Nixon loyalists, and a new exhibit on Watergate presents what the archive says is a balanced account of the scandal and drove Nixon from office. The average ticket price in Major League Baseball has more than tripled since 1991 to $26.74 last season from $8.34. India's population has grown 17.6% over the last decade to 1.2 billion people. India is now on course to pass China as the world's most populous nation by 2030. And since January, employment for Americans with a college degree or higher has grown by 521,000 jobs. For those with only a high school diploma, employment has fallen by 318,000 jobs. And now let's look at the poll watch for this week. The Japanese nuclear disaster has had little impact on Americans' view of nuclear power. 58% of Americans say nuclear power plants in the U.S. are safe, down just 2% from 2009. And 44% of baby boomers say they have little or no faith they'll have enough money when they retire. And 25% additionally to that say that they never plan to retire. Well, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We certainly hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long until next time.